It's now time for the Fantasy 411 podcast.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to the Fantasy 411. I'm Matthew Leach, talking fantasy baseball with MLB.com's lead fantasy writer, Fred Zinke. Stay with us till the end. We've got a little extra treat here. We're going to be talking with our friends from Yahoo Fantasy. But before that, we've got plenty to get to. So we will start with the news. And as we were exchanging final emails this morning about what we're going to talk about today, a couple of pieces of bad news from Red Sox camp. I think one a lot more concerning than the other. And that is David Price dealing with some, calling it forearm discomfort, more than usual. Apparently John Farrell said this is not an unusual thing for him to have some of in the spring, but that it is worse than usual. He has been scratched from his first Grapefruit League start, which was to be this weekend. I have seen some places that they are saying forearm, not elbow. But as somebody who has heard a whole lot of sore forearm turn into significant elbow injury, that just makes me nervous. It's kind of hard to even know what exactly we're dealing with right now, but people are drafting right now, so we kind of have to address it based on what we do know. Fred, how much, just right now, if you're drafting today, how much are you adjusting Price's value?
Yeah, I mean, that's the big question. I mean, we should have answers, you know, in a few days, but there are people drafting now. As you said, we decided to drop him in our rankings down a handful of spots and drop his innings from where we had them around 220 to around 200 or in the 190s. I forget which one, but and that moved him down basically from being a low-end ace to being now a number two starter. And I think that's kind of, if I was drafting now, it would be hard to resist him as my number two starter on the possibility that this turns out to not be much, but I wouldn't want to count on him as my number one.
And here's the thing with Price. I think this is the key, is that if you draft David Price, it's a little like John Lester. A big part of why you are drafting him is that floor. A big part of why you are intrigued by taking David Price is you say, well, look, even if, like last year, the ERA balloons, even if somehow he, you know, has some bad luck and ends up with 14 wins instead of 18, he's still going to give me a lot of innings. He's going to give me some pretty good ratios. He's going to give me a lot of strikeouts. And so no matter what, he's going to help me. If that's in question, I think that is more troublesome in when you start looking at David Price than some of the other guys who are more risk-reward. Some of these guys in that sort of low-end ace tier that we talk about, you know, a guy like a Syndergaard, for example, he has a sore forearm right now. We'd say, well, yeah, that's part of the cost of doing business. Price, you draft him in the hope that that's not part of the cost of doing business.
That's right. And, you know, where we moved him down, kind of puts him in with some other guys if this is the cost of doing business with Price, and it is if you draft him today, where we moved him down kind of puts him with Jacob DeGrom, Carlos Carrasco, some guys who could be really good for you, but also could have some injury problems, you know, give you 140 or 130 innings if things don't go their way this season. I think that's the way Price has to be viewed right now. I mean, he could give us anything from 220 innings to miss a lot of the season if you're drafting today and you don't really know which one. I also think one of my concerns now with this injury now coupled with last season is we can't say for sure that if Price pitches, he's going to be awesome,
right?
Because he wasn't awesome last year.
Right.
You know, for some of the players we have ranked above him, it kind of seems if they're pitching, then they're going to be great, and even if there are some injury concerns. So Price could be injured or great or something in the middle where he is pitching but has an ERA of 4, at which point you don't really want him in the top 3 spots in your rotation anyways.
Right. Also, a lot of news out of Fort Myers this week. Also this morning, Hanley Ramirez has a sore shoulder. I believe it's his back shoulder, which is a little less troublesome. Front shoulders for power hitters can be very scary, but a little soreness in his, I believe it's his right shoulder, which is his back shoulder. Can't throw, that's okay, because he'll be DHing most of the time anyway. Might miss the World Baseball Classic. This seems pretty minor. I mean, I'm pretty conservative on Ramirez anyway, only because he's coming off 3 consecutive years before last year that weren't that good, and because he does get dinged up sometimes. So to me, this is kind of the opposite of Price. That's kind of what you know you're signing up for with Ramirez. You know that last year is possible, but it's not the most likely outcome. Do you have more? Does this give you more pause on Ramirez than it does me?
No, the injury itself isn't that concerning to me. I think it's just a really nice spring training reminder for fantasy owners of Ramirez's long track record, because sometimes we get too caught looking just at last season where he played in 147 games. And, you know, whether it's this shoulder that holds him out of some games, and I know it won't affect him as much as a designated hitter, but, you know, if it does hold him out of some games, or if it's something else that crops up during the season, I think it's a good reminder that we should probably set expectations for Ramirez at 130 games or something like that, even if he's a designated hitter, and keep our expectations in check. Maybe a 23 homer prediction instead of going all in for the 30 that he hit last season, because this is someone who more seasons than not has bumps and bruises that slow him down.
And as you were talking about with Price, the other thing with Ramirez is he is not a good or hurt guy. He is a guy who has played through some stuff and has been not very good at times. And we'll talk more about this when we talk first baseman a little later, but I think it's important to remember that you can't look at Hanley Ramirez and say, well, okay, he might miss a couple, he might have a couple of DL stints, but if he gives me 130 games, he's still going to rake. He could hit 250 with 18 home runs in 120 games.
Yeah, you're totally right. He hit 249 in 2015, you know, 19 home runs, 105 games. Like, that is the downside of him. And a 250 hitter who doesn't really steal bases and has okay power, but nothing, like, really impressive, like, with the way power was up across baseball last season, you know, you're not making much of an impact in a mixed league with that type of production.
One more piece of Red Sox news before we move on, and I thought this one was very intriguing. Dustin Pedroia may lead off. He's led off some this spring, led off a little bit last year. Boy, it's an awfully daunting lineup if you're looking at him at the top of the order. I don't think he's a guy who would really change his approach. I think you could still count on him for the power. Does it affect him at all if you think he's probably going to – if he leads off, it probably – bumps his runs up, but probably hurts his RBI.
Yeah, it hurts his RBIs. I mean, it could give him a few more plate appearances, which means a few more at-bats, which means his 300 average, if he hits 300, which he has in his career, like, it means that average helps you just fractionally a little bit more. But overall, I think it doesn't change much as far as how I feel about him. To me, the big news is if he's leading off, is Andrew Benintendi hitting second, or who is hitting second? Because
right.
It seems like Mookie Betts is probably hitting third, so... you know, that's really the big change, because whoever hits second, that player is probably someone who we're envisioning right now either hitting second or hitting, like, seventh. And those are massive changes in value. Whether Pedroia hits first or second, I think he kind of is what he is. He's a fine mixed league second baseman who will get you the 15 homers and a half a dozen steals and hit 300 and score 90 to 100 runs. Totally valuable. He's not going to have a 25 homer season, though, or a 20 steal season, I don't think, ever again.
We move across the state to beautiful Port St. Lucie, home of the Grapefruit League's finest concession item, the taco and a helmet. Unsurprisingly, Lucas Duda is already banged up. I mean, you kind of know this is coming, so, you know, as two of the last remaining Lucas Duda believers, I think we just say, well, yeah, that's part of the package. The interesting thing here is what they're going to do about it, because it does not look like Wilmer Flores steps in there, in part because, and we'll talk about this in just a moment, David Wright is going to miss some significant time. So maybe Jay Bruce gets some time at first base. That doesn't really affect Bruce's value. It might affect Michael Conforto's value. Is he back on your radar?
Maybe last round of a 15, or last couple rounds of a 15-team league. I have heard some people out there, I think, jumping the gun on him and saying, you know, this puts him right back on the radar because Bruce is going to be the first baseman and, you know, Conforto is going to be in the outfield all the time. And I'm not there yet. Like, I know Conforto's talented, but he hasn't done a lot yet in the majors. He could be platooned. And I'm not totally writing off Duda yet. I think what happened with Duda is a reminder for me that we're probably not going to see a 150-game season out of him. You know, he had 153 in 2014. We're probably never going to see that again because there's going to probably be back issues during the season. That being said, I'm not writing off Duda to play in 120 games or something this year And that's enough to mean that Bruce is in the outfield most of the time and Conforto's not. So I'm not there with Conforto yet. I don't know if you're maybe more optimistic on him than I am, but I don't know if I would race out to pick him up in a 10 or 12 team league. I'm not interested yet, for sure.
I'm leaving the door cracked for this reason. And look, we talked last year, we'll talk again about spring training stats. In a nutshell, spring training stats are meaningless as a predictor of performance. With that said, managers watch spring training games real closely, and guys who perform really well in spring training doesn't necessarily mean they're going to perform in the season, but it can mean they're going to get appearances in the postseason. And early, very early in Grapefruit League play, Michael Conforto is crushing the ball. So the one way I think this changes is if you get that combination of circumstances. You get an opening in the lineup, and if he keeps tearing the cover off the ball here, then the whole conversation starts looking a little different, and the Mets start saying, well, what if this is a way to get Conforto in the lineup? What if we do believe this guy is going to hit the way we always thought he would, and maybe now we have to find a way to get him in? So I think, again, right now I'm not on board, but I'm keeping the door open because I see two different things happening right now that could create opportunities for him.
Yeah, I see that. I mean, when I was looking at it, I wish that one of those batters was right-handed.
Yep.
Because with Duda should be in the lineup against righties if he can play. Bruce should be in the lineup against righties. Conforto should be in the lineup against righties. I wish one of them was right-handed, and that would really set up a nice little platoon between two positions and three players. But that's not the case, and that's not going to change.
And then one other piece of news from Mets camp. David Wright, we don't know. I mean, this is the thing, is that David Wright has, they're calling it a shoulder impingement. He basically can't throw. He's out indefinitely. Basically, opening day is very much in doubt. It's hard for me to see him playing opening day. Two things about this. One, it looks like Jose Reyes is now the everyday third baseman, or at least the primary third baseman. So, one, how much do you like Jose Reyes if I tell you he's going to start the year getting nearly every day at bats and probably leading off in a lineup that's going to hit a lot of home runs?
Yeah, I'm starting to get interested in Reyes. With him at the top of the lineup, and their lineup, if it's healthy outside of Wright, is not bad. I think, and with Steeles being at a bit of a premium, Reyes is someone who, if he just ends up being the third baseman all season, could get you 20-25 steals, and could score 90 runs, something in that area, 85-90 runs. I mean, that has value. In a 10-team league, it's pretty marginal, but in a 12-team league, that means he should for sure be on a roster. And that's really the direction that I think we're going. I mean, I think we're all – I really liked David Wright when he was in the prime of his career. I really liked his game. But this is someone who has less than 300 at-bats total across the past two seasons. There's just not a lot of reason to be optimistic that this is all going to come together for him.
Let me throw one other – and this is hypothetical, but it ties together two things we were just talking about. Because we both said, boy, what if the Mets had another right-handed bat in that corner mix? And then David Wright, half-jokingly, but I don't think completely jokingly, said, maybe I need to get a first baseman's mitt. If his issue is throwing and he's otherwise okay, do you start at least keeping an eye on whether David Wright becomes part of that first base mix once he starts playing?
No, to me that makes perfect sense. I mean, it makes perfect sense in a lot of ways because a right Duda platoon, if they were both able to play, could help keep them both healthy. It gives Duda days off. It gives Wright a lot of days off. You know, Wright can pinch hit later in games. If they've got Bruce get some work in at first base during spring training, then Bruce could even move from the outfield to first base later in a game if he needed to. You know, and then Conforto comes in. So, I mean, yeah, I think that's a really interesting solution for a Mets team that seems to really want to have Wright as a part of it, if there's any way that they can do that. I mean, that would obviously mean that Wright isn't a mixed league factor at all,
right,
with the amount of playing time he would get. But it wouldn't change really anyone else, because Duda's probably going to sit against a lot of lefties anyways, even though he has had some success against them. But with his back and everything, that seems like a natural fit. So that would be an interesting way to get him in the lineup, and that would clear Reyes to just be the third baseman every day.
Yep. One other piece of news before we move on. The Cubs saying they're going to try and limit the innings on their starters. This kind of falls into a general category for me. You get a lot of these kinds of news, and sometimes it's we're going to do something creative with our bullpen, and sometimes it's we're going to do something creative with the lineup. My general feeling is that contending teams do what it takes to win, unless you're really talking about protecting a kid. And once we're talking about Julio Urías, and you're really looking out for a young player and putting him on some kind of restrictions, Joe Maddon can say they're going to take it easy on Lester and Arrieta, and he can have that in mind. But I bet that taking it easy happens a lot more in Phoenix right now than it does in Chicago and St. Louis and Milwaukee in June and July. So for me, I hear it, and I'm sure he's sincere in saying it, but I don't really think it's going to make a lot of difference. I don't adjust my view on Cubs starters at all. I don't downgrade their innings at all personally. Do you buy it more than I do?
I think I buy it a little more than you, just because it did basically happen last year. Like, they went with a six-man rotation later last season and really paced those pitchers for the postseason, and then they obviously went really deep into the postseason. So it makes sense they would do it again. Now, the big thing last year was they had this massive division lead,
right,
so they could do that. So I felt like Maddon saying that was almost his – I don't think he meant it this way, but when I read it, it was almost his way of saying he's already thinking that this club is good enough, and I think that they are, to get a 5-6-7 game lead in the division by the end of July and then cruise a little bit. I mean, last year, Lester threw 202 2/3 innings and led the team in innings, and was healthy all season. So I think that's what Maddon would like to do. I agree with you that if the Cardinals or the Pirates or something are two games behind them, I think then Lester will throw 215 innings or 220 innings because they'll need to get those innings out of them to win the division. But I think Maddon would like to do it, and I think he will take his foot off the gas if they can get that big lead with all the talent on their team.
Sure. No, I do agree with that. I think that's a lot harder to do than people think. I think that the reality suggests that even if the Cubs are the best team in the National League, it's really hard to win that number of games. And I think it's more likely, just because of sort of plexiglass principle, that they will have a fight on their hands and that they will run away.
Do you think that there's a chance that Maddon would shorten their starts a little bit earlier in the season to pace them? So, like, Lester's cruising through six, they're up 4-0. Or 4-1 or something like that. He would normally go out for the seventh, and Maddon, they have a pretty deep bullpen. Maddon would just say, you know what, you're done. As just kind of a way of maybe taking off 10 innings across his first 10 or 15 starts of the season.
I think you could definitely see that, but I think the practical reality of how that turns out, that's fewer games than we think of it, and I think the practical reality of that is that turns out to be 2 or 3 innings a guy.
Yeah, it's quite possible. And, I mean, these guys, we've talked about this before on the show, these guys are competitors. They want to win games.
Yep.
If a game's 2-1 for the Cubs, John Lester's cruising, he's not going to want to come out of that game. He's going to want to pitch that next inning, you know, get it deeper into the game, give himself a better chance to get a win and for the team to win the game. Like, you know, these are we're talking front office-type decisions, but they're players. And in the end, you got to keep them on side.
And it only has to blow up on you once before you don't do it again.
That's right, yeah.
We will talk about first baseman in just a moment, but before we switch to our first base preview, I want to take a moment to tell you about The Cut Forecast. The Cut Forecast is the podcast from the team of MLB.com's Cut 4 section, which focuses on the lighter side of baseball. If you've made it this far into our podcast, we really think you'll enjoy it. It'll make you laugh, and you might even learn something about baseball dogs or ballpark food. Last week's episode had an interview with Twins beat reporter Rhett Bollinger, who talked about Phil Hughes' Twitter drafts folder and Joe Mauer's secret rap studio. If that sounds like something you'd be into, search Cut Forecast, that's C-U-T number 4 C-A-S-T, in iTunes or wherever else you get your podcasts, and click subscribe. Cut 4 is a lot of fun. They do something different than we do elsewhere on MLB.com. They are funny people, and they are worth your time.
Yeah, I like listening to it. It's totally different from fantasy, but fantasy owners are all baseball fans from the beginning.
Yep.
So it takes you back to a lot of just the fun aspects of following a sport.
We now move on to talk first base, our first base preview. And tier one of first base has only one player, and that is Paul Goldschmidt. And to me, the question on Goldschmidt is, how high do you rate him overall? And I like Goldschmidt a lot, but I think it's fair to wonder, you know, you can look at his last 2 years and put them together two different ways. You can look at his 2015 and see the 33 homers, 110 RBI, and the 320. And you could look at the last 2 years, he's had 20 and 30 stolen bases, and you could see a guy who could go 30-30 and hit over 300 and be on the short list of the most valuable properties in fantasy baseball. You can also look at it and see that last year, despite playing pretty much every day, he had 24 homers, 95 RBI, hit 297, and know that sometimes, particularly with guys that kind of fit his profile, with big guys, first basemen, those stolen bases can go away in a hurry. Those guys can go from 20 or 30 to 10 real quick. And I can see a way where Goldschmidt is at 25 and 15, and suddenly he's not head and shoulders ahead of the rest of those guys. I'm not saying that's going to happen. I think you kind of have to be aware of it, though. So to me, the question is, how high overall do you have Goldschmidt, and how far ahead of Tier 2 do you have him?
Yeah, I'm kind of the low man, I find, on Goldschmidt this year. And it, for me, the concern is where the steals total is going to go. With the Diamondbacks being under new management, he's their franchise player. Not many management crews, I think, are comfortable with their franchise player attempting 35 or 40 steals in a season. So that's my source of concern. This is where I kind of have a mid-first round, and to me that puts him a little bit above Tier 2, but not a lot. I've kind of come to accept that I think Goldschmidt's an awesome hitter, but I don't think he is a 40-homer hitter, or no, maybe even not really consistently a 35-homer hitter. So if he's kind of a 30-homer hitter who gets 50, I feel like 15 or 20 steals is a reasonable expectation for this year. I'm really not expecting 25 to 30. I don't know if you think that's being pessimistic really at all, but it sounds like maybe you're kind of thinking in the same direction, where the steals are a little more tenuous for him than for someone like Jose Altuve that stole 30 last year.
Right, I think that's the key, is that there's no reason to think that Altuve's dropped. It's just part of his game. It's what he does. I mean, unless he hits 40 home runs and just isn't on first base that often, I don't think there's any reason to think that his steals drop. But you look in the past, you know, Albert Pujols never stole 30, but Albert Pujols was once a base-stealing threat. Jeff Bagwell, early in his career, was a base-stealing threat. These guys, you know, I'm calling this up right now to make sure I have this right. You know, Jeff Bagwell, 21, 31, 19, 30, 9, 11, 7, 11. You know, those kinds of guys, it can go away real quick. And so I'm not saying it will, but I'm just saying, I think we're saying the same thing, that you just kind of have to be prepared that that's not a given. That even, you know, average the last 2 years, it comes out to 25 and a half, I think, or 26. I don't even think that's a given. And so you just kind of have to be prepared that you're getting a guy who might steal a lot of bases, not a guy who will steal a lot of bases.
Yeah, for sure. Goldschmidt is probably just as close to the Josh Donaldson, Manny Machado kind of group that's a little later in the first round, not maybe at the very end, but two-thirds of the way through the first round. I think he's just as close to that group as he is to the Chris Bryant, Nolan Arenado, those like 40-homer,
yep,
you know, guys, Mookie Betts, you know, who you should be able to bank with more speed to go along with his power. I don't put Goldschmidt with that other group at the very top of the first round.
And so we look at Tier 2, and to me, this is a group where there's a guy I see kind of a Tier 1.5. Tier 2 is Miguel Cabrera, Anthony Rizzo, Joey Votto, and Freddie Freeman. To me, and I have in the past been kind of a skeptic on Miguel Cabrera. I've kind of waited for him to come to earth. But, you know, aside from an injury-shortened and still outstanding 2015, Miguel Cabrera hasn't hit lower than 313 since 2008. That even includes the injured year. He hasn't had fewer than 108 RBI, except for that 1 year, in ages. He is still, you know, I think the one thing you maybe aren't sure about is maybe he doesn't repeat the 38 home runs. Maybe he's a 30-homer guy. But Cabrera is still a guy you almost certainly pencil in for at least 310, 100, 110 RBI, 30-plus homer, 90 runs. To me, he is a step ahead of the guys in that group and as close for me to Goldschmidt as he is to somebody like Votto or Freeman.
Yeah, I'm with you. I think you hit the nail on the head when you said it's how you value Cabrera right now is how much do you believe in the 38 homers last season? I mean, he's pretty much the best batting average lock there is at any position. Last year was 38. The year before, if you pace it out to a full season in that injury affected year, was basically a 25, 26 homer season. And the year before, he hit 25 in a full season. Now, prior to that, he was a 40 homer player, but we had those two seasons prior to 2016, you know, where he was like a mid to high 20s homer guy. So we kind of split the difference on our preview this year and put him, I think, at 33 homers, took some power off, but not down back down into the 20s, and that pushed him out of tier one. I would feel really comfortable taking him at the end of the first round and pairing him with someone like Trey Turner. So a speed guy, you know, mixed with a really solid power hitter batting average asset in Cabrera.
It's interesting to me that he's kind of, there are a lot of parallels between his career and Pujols' career, and yet the way they sort of entered their decline phases was totally different, and Pujols has kind of turned into this. And now Pujols gave away batting average and kept his power. Cabrera has kind of given away some power and kept his ability to get base hits. It's kind of an intriguing difference between the two of them. Excuse me. Elsewhere in Tier 2, honestly, and this is funny because this is a guy we were both down on last year, I might like Freeman the most of those guys. I love Votto. I would take Votto on my team over any of them. But on a fantasy team, boy, Freeman was really good and really steady before he got hurt. He was outstanding last year. He's going to be in an improved lineup. He's still young. I'm pretty high on Freeman. Convince me that Rizzo is ahead of Freeman.
Yeah, I think I'm really high on the Braves lineup, so you're preaching to the choir when you talk about that, and I'm high on Freeman's skill set. I think with Votto, or with Rizzo, I should say, it's actually a much shorter span than Cabrera, but it's similar in that the floor for Rizzo in hitting in the middle of that Cubs lineup seems to be really high. I mean, he's had 31 or 32 homers in each of the last three seasons. You know, and his batting average in those three seasons has been between 278 and 292. So he's not amazing, but he's really stable. And if you think 30 homers and a 285 average hitting third or fourth in the Cubs lineup, you're probably going to get 100 runs or 100 RBIs out of that and probably 90 runs. And that's pretty much what he's been the past couple years. It's just a really nice, safe second-round pick. And with Freeman, like I believe that most of what Freeman did last year is sustainable. At the same time, I don't think the Braves are ready to be the Cubs as far as the lineup goes. And we do have to accept the fact that, you know, prior to last season, Freeman had never even hit 25 homers in a year. So there, I guess there's maybe more of a chance that his power goes way backwards, where it seems really unlikely for Rizzo.
That's fair. And we also don't entirely know how the ballpark is going to play.
That's right.
It's. I asked Mark Bowman about this. It's about 100 feet lower elevation than Turner Field, which is not enormous, but it's a slight difference. I think we can be confident it's going to play hitter-friendly, but maybe not extremely so. We move to Tier 3, and this is where we start getting into real compromises, and it's a matter, to some extent, it's strategy. It's what do you already have and what do you need, because we're looking at Edwin Encarnacion, who kind of splits the difference, actually, Chris Davis, Hanley Ramirez, Jose Abreu. And so the question is, are you interested in an Abreu type who in the past couple years has been 290 to 300, 25 home runs? Are you interested in a Chris with a C Davis type where he might hit 190 but is almost certainly going to hit 40 or more home runs? Like I said, I think Encarnacion is kind of the height of that group because he's the one guy who could hit 270 and 35. I think Hanley is the bottom of that group. And the other two guys, it's kind of a question of what you need.
Yeah, I agree. And we are kind of the low men on Encarnacion in our preview this year, and most people would have him in Tier 2. And I can't totally argue with that. I have some reasons why we didn't put him in Tier 2, the strikeout rate and the park switch and things like that. But you're right. He's kind of the class of Tier 3, you know. And then it's kind of your risk tolerance. Abreu seems to have a really low possibility of having a monster season with the way he's been trending. And just he hasn't shown us really, especially since he first arrived, a little bit, but not lately, like a lot of power, but he's solid. And then Davis and Ramirez, the range of outcomes are so high. I think out of that group, I actually do prefer Davis. I think the power is pretty locked in with him. Even last year when he wasn't really going well, he's hitting for a lot of power. And his batting average is going to fluctuate, and you kind of just need to ride the wave on that and hope that it finishes at 250 or something around that range. Because in some years it finishes higher than that.
Well, and that's the thing. The risk is really high, but also three of the last 5 years, he's hit 262 or higher. It's not that like he doesn't have that in him. He has it. You just kind of can't count on him to do it. And then we move to Tier 4, and those names are Will Myers, Albert Pujols, and Eric Hosmer. And again, it sort of comes down to what do you want, because Hosmer probably will get you RBI, though I'm not convinced he's a 100 RBI guy. Probably will hit for a little more average, whereas Pujols, if he plays, remains a pretty good power source. Myers, you know, I don't think we know exactly what he is. He gave us great half a season. To me, again, it's kind of what you need at that point. Is there somebody from that group that you particularly like?
So I don't really like Tier 4 at all. And
yeah.
To me, Tier 4 is maybe a good reason to get a first baseman out of, if you don't get Goldschmidt, which it sounds like you and I probably won't be the guy who gets Goldschmidt in many drafts, but to really consider one of those Tier 2 guys like Miggy or Rizzo, and because I don't really like Tier 4. I don't think we know what Myers is after him. He really struggled in the second half of last season, and the Padres would probably be my pick to finish last in runs scored this year, which isn't going to help him, obviously. And Hosmer showed some concerning trends with his skill set last season that were kind of masked by some good fortune, and then Pujols coming off another injury. I think I like Pujols the most, but I'm a little worried if I'm counting on any of those three players as my first baseman. And I also think if I miss the early tiers, I may just wait on that tier and grab someone who's not, you know, in our top 12 first baseman and just invest much less later on.
I'm definitely with you on that. I think that's a very defensible option if you start looking at somebody like an Adrian Gonzalez further down. This is about the point where I step out. Now we're going to bring in Andy Behrens from Yahoo, who is going to further our first base analysis by comparing our rankings with those on his site. Fred, I'm going to throw it over to you before I go. Thanks, everybody, for listening. Thanks, Fred, for taking some time to talk.
We don't have a lot of guests on the show, but it's my pleasure to bring on Andy Behrens from Yahoo. I've known Andy for a few years since we started playing in Tout Wars together. We don't do that anymore together. We're in different leagues now, but Andy's one of the best fantasy game players and writers in the industry. Andy, thanks for coming on the show. It's a real pleasure for us to have you on.
Oh, I appreciate the opportunity to be on. You probably don't talk about it enough, but Fred is like one of the true sharks among like actual players. you're about as good as it gets among, you know, there's plenty of experts that talk the game really well and don't necessarily execute in the actual playing of the game quite as well as you do. You are a masterful trader, which is always good in industry league. So it's a pleasure to be on.
I always say that I make the most good trades in a league. I also probably make the most bad trades in a league. I just end up making the most trades, and then we see where it's almost like a tornado spinning through your league, and then we just see at the end, once it spins through town, where everything's left lying around.
Oh, people don't realize how, like, in experts leagues, you know, a lot of people who play them tend to think that they just get, I don't want to sweep with a big broad brush here, but there's so many people who are afraid to make deals, right, because the idea of losing a trade is so much worse to them than the idea of actually losing the league. That they, there's so many people who just don't throw themselves out there, and you are so fun to play with because you're always looking. Plus, you're good at selling a trade. Like when you come to somebody with a deal, the pitch is really good, and you always give a little bit of thought to what that team would actually need. So, always fun to play with you, and certainly fun to talk with you.
Yeah, no, I agree with you that a lot of people are hesitant, and I don't even know if it's just in expert leagues, but people are hesitant to make trades, and I always try to think that, you know, like you and I take fantasy sports and fantasy baseball as seriously as anyone, like it's our career, but at the same time, like when you make a trade in your own league, like you're not mortgaging your house, like no matter where the trade ends up, if it's terrific or if it's a disaster, like you're still going to go home to the same people, you know, in the same house and everything. Like, you know, I mean, like I said, like we do this for a living. And at the same time, I still think, you know, if I trade Mookie Betts for Jose Altuve and it doesn't work out, everything I have in life is not going to be taken away. We are still playing these games.
Right. The worst thing that ever happens to you in life is that you lost a fantasy baseball trade.
You're doing pretty well in that case. Yeah. So anyways, I wanted, before we talk first baseman and you can further our discussion on them, I wanted to mention, you know, so with the Yahoo leagues, you know, we think Yahoo leagues are an awesome place to sign up as far as hosting your league. Like they're just, I played in a lot of leagues hosted by your site. I find your site as easy to use as far as just the nut, and as you said, I'm a really active owner. So for me, the nuts and the bolts of how a site works, as far as how you make trades and view your team and see free agents and sort things, that stuff is vitally important to me. And I'll be honest, there are some significant sites out there that I don't really enjoy doing my basic transactions on, and I've always really enjoyed doing them on every league that I've played on Yahoo. So I think it's a really good place for people, you know, to have their league hosted. Why don't you maybe talk about some of the options that the people would have as far as what they can sign up for, and, you know, and why maybe it's a good choice for a lot of people listening right now?
I do appreciate that, because this is one of those. Well, I've been at Yahoo for 10 years now, and before I worked there, virtually all of my fantasy leagues were already at Yahoo. And the one thing that we've always nailed throughout time has been, you know, it's a really intuitive user experience, right? It's very easily played. It's very easy to navigate yourself around the player pool, around the site. So that's always been great. It's always been reliable. Recent years, we have what I think is a really, really good fantasy app. It's an award-winning app, so that's been good. I tend to play more on my phone now than I ever did. I'm probably 75% mobile when I'm making transactions, when I'm making trades now. So that is increasingly important. We have a free game. We have pro leagues now, right? You can throw a little bit of money into the equation, make it a little bit more interesting. So that's good. The personally, and this is, you know, as somebody who plays mostly dynasty leagues in fantasy baseball, we've done such good work over the last, like, I would say 4 or 5 years of really fleshing out our player pool to include, you know, hundreds of the most interesting minor league prospects. That used to be from, you know, I probably shouldn't even talk about what I have thought of as holes in our game, but that used to be the hole in the game, right? Like, years ago, there were just no minor leaguers available to you. And who knew when they were going to pop up in the player pool, right? Like, that used to be a thing. And now they're all there. So now we have all the top prospects in the game. So it's become a great place to host a dynasty league as well.
Yeah, and I mean, and I've been looking through some of your draft content, which it's nice where people can sign up for a league and then also have all the content right there for them to read, you know, the preview articles and things like that. And so for our first base discussion now, Matthew and I already talked about our rankings and our tiers and kind of where we're slotting players. So what I did today, just kind of for fun, because people get a lot of my opinions and a lot of Matthew's opinions on the show, you know, now I'm going to kind of highlight some of the spots at first base where we saw something a little bit differently than you did personally on your rankings on the site. And I think in some of these cases, we're the ones in the minority, but I wanted to give listeners a different opinion. So to start us off, we have Freddie Freeman higher than Edwin Encarnacion. You have Edwin higher. What makes you either optimistic on Edwin or pessimistic on Freeman, you know, heading into this year? Or why would you go with Edwin?
Yeah, this felt interesting to me because I don't feel like I dislike Freddie Freeman, right? Like,
you probably don't. You're in the majority on this one for sure.
Yeah, I had him in a couple of places last year. It was a really good experience. I suppose this comes down to whether you believe that Freeman fully keeps last year's gains, right? So his slugging percentage jumped 100 points. Homers nearly doubled from his previous full season. So, it was a year in which everybody hit home runs, I suppose, but Freeman bangs out 34. The previous five seasons, though, power totals that you could reasonably expect from Freddie Freeman were in the high teens to the low 20s. So it's hard for me to still not project him as that guy, as a guy who probably comes in around maybe it's 24, 25, 26 home runs. You know, I think he can hit 290 and be a 90-90 guy in terms of runs and RBI, so that's awesome. That makes you a top 10 first baseman. It's just power remains sort of the big open question for me. And I look at Edwin. He just hit 42 home runs, Great Park, obviously, hit 42 home runs, led the AL in RBIs, hasn't hit fewer than 34 home runs in any of the last 5 years, and he remains in a really friendly park and a terrific lineup. So it's super easy for me to project another, say, 35 homers, 110 RBIs out of Edwin. Granted, the average isn't going to be exactly where Freeman's is, but in terms of runs and power production, I would give that slight edge to Encarnacion.
Yeah, you're right. I think even with us having Freeman higher, I think most people would agree Encarnacion will probably produce more home runs and RBIs, so it's whether Freeman's batting average can make up for that. And some of that will have to do with Freeman's average, but also Encarnacion. He struck out a little more often last season, so you know where his, if his batting average settles in the 250 range or the 270 range will probably would swing that. Moving on to the next one, we have Chris Davis ahead of Jose Abreu. Matthew and I just talked about them as a little bit of a contrast of, you know, volatility versus stability. You're
right.
Taking the stability of Abreu over the volatility of Davis. Why is that?
Yeah, well, you nailed it there, I think, with the volatility versus predictability conversation. Davis is just, he's such a tough player, right? Like, so first of all, his one great skill has become increasingly easy to find, right? So power production really up across baseball last year. Like, it's not so rare to find a 30-homer guy anymore. Of course, Davis has extreme power. In his best years, he can give you 50. He hit 221 last season, and he's just a couple years removed from batting below 200, from batting 196. So for the batting average risk that he carries, if I'm drafting him, I need him to hit like 45 home runs, 48 home runs, something like that. I can't have 575 at-bats of a guy who hits like 210 or 220 because that just sets me too far back in other places. And I will concede that Jose Abreu just does not have that same power upside. I don't know that anybody in baseball does. But, I mean, Abreu also just delivered the worst fantasy season of his three major league years, and he hit 25 homers with 100 RBIs, and he was batting 293. So his floor is just so much safer than Davis's. The run and RBI production is very similar. We basically know that Abreu is going to hit for average. It's a friendly park. You know, this is one where, call me a coward, but I come down on the side of the guy with the more bankable numbers with the higher floor.
Yeah, no, Davis's career batting average is 250, but, I mean,
which is crazy because he's done it by hitting, like, 200 and then hitting 280, right?
That's right. So it's almost like you feel like you won't get 250. You'll either get 265 or 270, or you'll get 220. And so I feel, yeah, you're not willing to live with that fluctuation of, because it's not, you're right, he's a career 250 hitter where it seems unlikely you'll get a 250 average from him. Which is
that's
really
it's
unique.
The last thing you're going to get out of it.
Yeah.
You'd be a fool to predict a 250 average from him.
Yeah, and I mean,
you're totally right. It's for sure.
Yeah, I'm willing to ride the roller coaster with him a little bit more than most people. At the same time, I will acknowledge he is on the wrong side of 30. So, I mean, if you're with someone with such massive fluctuations, maybe I should take a little more of a pessimistic. And someone
Davis,
who's so strikeout prone.
Davis to me is one of those guys that you almost have to plan to draft because I think you need to. When you're just projecting results for your team, you obviously, again, as you say, you can't project him for a 250 average. I think you almost have to plan for the worst-case scenario, and let's just assume that he hits 210, but he gives you the power production that you need. And now I've got a plan to draft him, and I've got to find guys who I know can offset that. Assuming that I still want to compete in batting average, I got to make sure that I land one or two guys who I can confidently say are going to be like 310, 320 guys who can offset the damage that Davis is going to do.
Yeah, and I've always thought that the plan also with drafting Davis is that, as I say, ride the roller coaster. Like there's probably not a huge roller coaster with Abreu. There's ups and downs with every hitter, but with Davis, I think if you draft him, you're saying that if he's hitting 180 at the end of April, you're still in, right? Because you're hoping for the 290 and 12 home runs in May. Like, you're in pretty much all the way, even through the slumps, and you're not going to panic and sell. If you're going to panic the first time Davis slumps, and trade him for 50 cents on the dollar, then just don't draft him.
Because that's the Chris Carter thing, right? Like,
you
finally decide to sit him, and that's when he has the three-game series in which he...
Yeah, you're either in or you're out with players like that, and you just bank that the 40 homers will be there at the end of the season, and you cross your fingers on the average.
That's a good call.
Yeah, the next one is Eric Hosmer, who actually we have Eric Hosmer ahead of Carlos Santana, and now before you came on, Matthew and I both said negative things about Eric Hosmer and some signs we're concerned about him, but we still were okay enough with him to put him ahead of Carlos Santana. You have Santana a little higher. Yeah, persuade me to move, you know, Hosmer down in our rankings because I feel like I am a little bit ready to do that. But that being said, Hosmer has been pretty productive the last couple seasons.
He has. Hosmer, to me, is just one of those guys who is so much more valuable in reality, perhaps, than in fantasy. My main issue is that by the standards of his position, right, by the first base standards or corner infield standards, we just know with relative confidence that he's going to be some sort of liability in home runs. The career high in homers is 25. That was last year. It was a year that everybody homered. He's normally in the high teens. I think he had a season with 9 homers. He's just a dominant ground ball line drive guy. It is not a power hitter's profile. Like, if he were to ever hit 30, it would be because almost everything he hits in the air leaves the park. So I just, there's very little power upside here, and that is a worry for me at first base, because now I draft Hosmer at first base. Now I got, okay, where am I going to get my power? Because it ain't coming there at a position where everybody else is getting it. Now, if he could make up for this by being a 320 hitter, that would be awesome, but he's a career 277 guy. So at least Santana, for me, has a couple tools that separate him. He's, you know, terrific power. It was 34 homers last year. He's had some seasons in the high 20s. The guy, and this is a problem, because I was just talking about Chris Davis as if his average was a bad thing. You're basically guaranteed that Carlos Santana is not going to hit for a high average. It's not going to be, he doesn't have quite the batting average floor that Davis does, right? Like, there's no threat that Carlos Santana is going to hit 200 for you. He might hit 235. I will concede that. He might be like a 260, 265 guy in his best years, but he lives on base. So I am getting runs here. I'm probably getting 85 to 90 runs in a healthy season, and he always plays 150 games, so I'm pretty much guaranteed that I'm going to get a healthy season out of him as well. It's Friendly Park. You can pretty much book him for 25 homers, potential for 35, and I know, worst case, he's going to go like 85-85 for me.
Yeah, no, and yeah, I like actually that you mentioned Davis while you were talking about him, in the sense of Davis's batting average is all over the map. And Santana, he's been really healthy the past 6 seasons, but his power has been a little bit all over the map, where he has a couple seasons right. of fewer than 20 homers, and then he has 3 seasons with more than 25, and then last season was 34. And so it's hard. I think that really defines it as, you know, is Santana the high 20s home run guy, or is he the 20 homer guy? And that really decides if he's more powerful than Hosmer or not.
Yeah, it's a good call. The whole thing swings on where the homers, to an extent, can be a little bit fluky. And the whole thing hinges on where the power comes in, right? Like, if he hits 32 bombs, he's probably going to outproduce Hosmer for fantasy. And if it's just in the mid-20s, probably not.
Yeah. And then the last one I wanted to do, we have Brandon Belt ahead of Adrian Gonzalez. I'm a bit of a Brandon Belt guy. I think a lot of people still have Gonzalez ahead of Belt, which I don't totally argue with. You're one of them. Is this just long-term track record with Gonzalez and, you know, just feeling, you know, he's done this, he's had a lot of successful fantasy seasons, whereas Belt, like, just has never really kind of broken through?
This is such a funny thing, because if you could just, if we just put both of these guys in neutral parks, you know, if I didn't have to worry about where Belt has to do most of his hitting, I would feel a lot better about him. It's tough to make a living as a left-handed slugger in San Francisco, right? We just don't see a lot of huge power seasons. He's never given us one. I mean, just, you know, you look at all the things that Brandon Belt has never done in the majors. He hasn't scored 80 runs yet, although he's probably going to have a privileged batting order position this year. He hasn't hit 20 homers, hasn't driven in 90, hasn't hit 290. If you could put him, I don't know, let's put him in Yankee Stadium, let's put him a lot of places, I would probably like Brandon Belt more than Gonzalez at this point in Gonzalez's career arc. I just can't get there with Belt quite yet. Gonzalez has done so many great things just routinely, right? He's always 90 RBIs. That's 10 straight years of it. He's a career 290 hitter. I get it. He turns 35 soon. In May, he turns 35. The 30-homer days are behind him. The 40-homer days are certainly behind him. So I don't mean to say that he has this ceiling that's crazy. But he still gives us, you know, 150, 155 games a season. He hits in the absolute heart of a great batting order. I expect the Dodgers to score a ton of runs. Everybody does. He just still offers a little bit better power than Belt, and likely a better or similar batting average, and the RBI production is just so bankable.
Yeah, I like it. I totally, you know, I can't argue too much with anything you said. I feel like Belt could still take one step forward. Maybe I'm, like, just having too much patience for him.
No, this is one of those things where, like, if I were just drafting from scratch the league to play like real baseball this year, I would for sure have Brandon Belt ahead of him. Like, I think he's a slightly better hitter at this stage. The part gets me, and the team context matters.
Yeah, I think this is a cool discussion because it showed how, I have lots of reasons for ranking someone in one way. You have lots of reasons. I mean, we didn't compare Paul Goldschmidt with Adrian Gonzalez. And, there's things that are just sensible. But, during your draft, there's a lot of really tight decisions, and you make really good arguments on both sides of it. So, I want to thank you for coming on today. We're going to do this again real soon. And then I also wanted to say, thanks for inviting me into the Yahoo Friends and Family League. We're going to do that next week, and I'll probably talk about that on here a little bit next week and talk about it on your podcast. I think it's a really cool rule that new joiners to that league get the first overall pick. So,
that is a league where Scott Pianowski and I both agreed behind the scenes that we desperately need you. It is so difficult sometimes. Other than myself, Scott, Chris Liss, who else? Not many other people. We happen to have collected a bunch of people in that league who are very difficult to trade with. and so we needed you in a big way. Like, that league to me is to the point where if somebody extends a fair offer to me, I just, like, knee-jerk accept it because I want to create a little bit of, fluidity. I want people making transactions.
Yeah.
So it's just a gift to have you there.
Well, I'm looking forward to it. And as I said, thank you. Thanks for coming on with us this week.
Awesome. Thanks for having me, man.
Yeah, and as Matthew would say, everyone, and he already said once, but I'll say it again, thanks, everyone, for listening. Thanks, Andy, and thanks to Matthew for taking time to talk this week.